This is a self-interview of William Ogden Farber, a 1935 Ph.D. in political science at the University of Wisconsin, period. The interview is part of the University of Wisconsin History Project and is being conducted on July 1st, 1984 at my home here in Vermilion, South Dakota, 57069. At 413 East Clark, where I reside, period. My telephone number, in case there are any follow-up questions, is 605-624-3147, period. I'm very happy to participate in this project because the 2 years, 1933 to 1935, that I spent at the University of Wisconsin were among the most delightful in my life, and they proved to be very significant in my subsequent career. Since 1935, I would describe myself as a practicing political scientist. That is, what the atmosphere of the University of Wisconsin in the 30s did for me was to impress the importance of combining theory with practice, the need to apply political science to contemporary problems and needs, as can very well be imagined. The 30s were most important to social scientists, and indeed it was this need for a policy change and policy innovation that attracted me to political science originally, and Madison did much to stimulate what was already becoming a conviction on my part that there was a great need to know what to do and how to do it, period. My career can be as found sketched out in the varying editions of Who's Who in America. Specifically, the 40th edition would give a rather complete summary of my involvement in both teaching and in government positions, period. Excuse me, period. As you can see, I use the recorder often for dictation purposes, and I hope you will excuse any reference to punctuation in the interview subsequently. To take up the questions that you have posed specifically, I was born in Geneseo, Illinois, on July the 4th, 1910. My childhood was spent in Geneseo, Illinois, where indeed my great-great-grandfather is buried, and the family has been subsequently. My schooling was in the Geneseo Public Schools, and then I attended the Northwestern University on a scholarship program for 4 years, receiving my bachelor's degree in political science with a minor in history, and my master's from Wisconsin, from Northwestern, where I was a Harris scholar in political science. Much of my childhood years found me employed in the family grocery business, a rather good business, and it was excellent training, I discovered subsequently, in that it made me regard to people as potential customers, and I was early conditioned to trying to motivate people. Indeed, this has carried over into my subsequent career, so that I look upon a new student as a customer, and I think, well, what can I do to motivate the student along the lines that I think desirable? My career at Northwestern was most satisfactory. I loved political science from the very beginning, and I was able, with the scholarship assistance I received in the 30s, which of course was a troublesome economic time, and while at Northwestern, indeed, the banks were once closed in the Roosevelt administration, so that I felt that I was had made substantial progress in my educational attainments. And I was on the dean's list, I think, every year, and was elected my junior year to Phi Beta Kappa. When I attempted to secure, and after graduation with a bachelor's degree as well as the master's, teaching employment, because I felt that it was important to get some teaching experience before going on for the doctorate. But the situation in terms of getting employment was simply hopeless. I attempted at one small town to get a job teaching Latin for $900 a year, and I lost out. When it came to then turning to getting a doctorate, I was given a fellowship at Northwestern University, and then luckily the offer came to attend the University of Wisconsin as a university fellow. I consulted with Dean Alton, James Alton James, at Northwestern, Dean of the Graduate School, and said there is no question of what a person who's had 5 years at Northwestern should change institutions. And it was a very fortunate change, because at Northwestern I had had somewhat conservative type of approaches to governmental problems, and Wisconsin was to be the breath of fresh air. The graduate program which I took at the University of Wisconsin was very flexible. For example, I decided to split the minor between history and economics. When I went to consult with Professor Heseltine about the minor in constitutional history, he said, well, you've had the year course with James Alton James. He said, there's no point in your taking the one course that we're offering here at Wisconsin. Why don't you just work as an independent student and prepare an outline of a course in constitutional history with supporting materials? And so this is what I did. And periodically I went in and talked with Professor Heseltine as he sat in his chair there, puffing his pipe. He was not demanding in really in any way, and the materials that I collected were to serve as very useful guides to a course that I subsequently gave during the summers at University of South Dakota in constitutional history. I felt I really learned a great deal, and I still have the outlines that I prepared at that time. Harold Groves, of course, was a marvelous instructor, and the courses that I took with him were the first semester on taxation, the second course was on expenditures, which is the way it was divided in those days, and then I took his seminar. It was in this seminar that we had a number of guest speakers, and where we examined their contribution and the current problems which they're faced. And it was this format that I really liked and have used very extensively myself in teaching at the University of South Dakota. I came to know Errol Groves fairly well and made use of his work when subsequently I was teaching courses in the state and local government. And on occasion we had our letters crossed, we exchanged letters a couple of times. But now, so far as the department was concerned, and political science, I was assigned to Professor von Kuchen, who was just, I believe, arrived from Duke, and who had had minimal experience in guiding graduate students. I was intending, and did, enlarge on my master's thesis at Northwestern on the doctrine of political questions in the Supreme Court, investigate judicial self-limitation in the Supreme Court. It turned out that I really knew more about the subject than Professor von Kuchen, and he very much let me work on my own. I read all the cases of the Supreme Court of the United States from 1910 to 1933, and carefully cataloged, analyzed them. And I think did a very competent piece of research. The material before 1910 had been available in a different form, so that I was able to make a rather comprehensive survey of the subject. In those days, you had to take writtens in, I believe it was four out of five fields, one of which was political theory. And the work that I did in political theory was with, fortunately, John Goss, who was, of course, a very famous professor and was later to go to Harvard. My association with John Goss was fairly close. He was a very shy person. Later on, when I was to give a paper on Missouri Valley development at the American Political Science Association, Goss attended it and subsequently sent me a book, which I still have. It's a sort of an appreciation of what one of his students had done. I once visited Goss while he was at Harvard, and his heart was always with the University of Wisconsin, I think, rather than with Harvard. My work with von Kuchen was really in the field of international law, and I took a year's work with von Kuchen in international law, and that was one of my exams was in that field. Another was in comparative government, where, of course, I had Professor Ogg. Professor Ogg's course on English government the first semester and other governments the second was very exacting and very thorough. I just had all kinds of appreciation of Professor Ogg. He was just such a hard worker. You go in his office, it's surrounded by all the books since he was editor of the American Political Science Review, and you felt somehow that you were almost in the presence of the United States Supreme Court. Each year had the graduate students at his home. And I can remember in October, I believe it was, of that first year that I was there, I was invited to Sunday dinner. And it was, well, I was very scared at the, I was just awed by Professor Ogg and his red-headed wife. I still remember that the salad that was served was alternating wedges of avocado and grapefruit. It was marvelous. It was my first time that I'd ever had avocado and grapefruit together in the way that she had it prepared. My course in public administration was taken with Walter Sharp, who subsequently was become a great authority on bureaucracies, particularly, I think, in Egypt, and to be a teacher at Yale. All in all, as you can see, I really felt that I had a marvelous instruction. And Ogg so arranged it that on my fellowship, which turned out to be for the 2 years, the first year was concerned with coursework. The second year, with the exception of the one class that I took with Gauss in political theory the first semester, I was completely free to work on my dissertation. It was a marvelous type of division. It was amazing, in the light of what you see with these present graduate programs, that it was able to work out in that fashion. In part, this was due to the very fine background that I had at Northwestern University. And in those days, there was not the proliferation of courses in either institution, for that matter. Most courses were just the fundamental courses, and both graduate and undergraduates were in the same class. I felt that there was no handicap in this kind of a situation, and this subsequent insistence on separation on the part of accrediting agencies, I think of as being absurd. Now, the fellowship that I had for $600 was the university fellowship, and also carried a waiver of tuition. And because of the economy was so bad, however, they required you, if you were single, to live in the graduate residence center. This was Richardson in the Adams Hall. And there were about 30 to 40 graduate students living together. This, of the $600 fellowship, accounted for $340. Thus, the check that I received on a 10-month basis was $26 a month. And I must say that I was able to live on $26 a month, with the room and board provided by the $340. Now, I did serve the second year as a graduate assistant for one section with Grayson L. Kirk, who was later to become president of Columbia University. It was not that it was required, and Ogg made it very clear that as a university fellow, I did not have to become a graduate assistant, but I felt that if I was going to seek a teaching job the second semester, it was all important that I have my record that I'd spent one semester teaching as a graduate assistant. And so this was worked out. I think I had 20 students that met once a week. There was minimal type of supervision, and we graded the papers in the section and gave the grade. Grayson Kirk was an extremely popular lecturer, which surprised me because he stuttered in class and had quite a stammering problem. But nevertheless, Kirk was to become extremely important as an educator subsequently. Three other professors warrant mentioning that were there at the time. Chester Lloyd Jones was a great authority on Latin America. And at our graduate meetings, or meetings of graduate students, I remember meeting him and becoming very much excited about some of the problems of the Latin American area. John Salter who was the long-haired professor, very popular with the women, and who had let his hair down, so to speak, and written about Philadelphia politics, was considered to be sort of a gadfly type of professor, and some of the teachers felt that he was not, his research was not up to Wisconsin standards. E.E. Woody was spending most of his time helping with the drafting of the Social Security Act and its amendments. And he is one of the people who very much impressed me with the interrelationship of government to social problems and the need to get social scientists involved in practical politics, much in the same manner as I was impressed by Groves, but I did not have either Woody or Jones as a teacher. I did have the impression with respect to the administration of the department that what Ogg said pretty much determined what was done. And there were references to what the old man wanted done. I felt that criticisms of Ogg were unwarranted because I found him so eminently fair. And frankly, I liked his style of administration because when he said something, you knew that it was going to be done that way. And I'm afraid that he became a role model for me since I was to serve for 38 years as chairman of the political science department at the University of South Dakota. And I am afraid that the type of criticism there was of Ogg would also subsequently have applied to me. But I have long felt that strong departments in any institution are those that have rather permanent chairmen who molded the character of a department, and when the chairman spoke, it had some meaning, and it did not take some sort of subsequent faculty vote to determine whether or not there was ratification or denial. I do not recall that there was regular meetings of students and faculty, but there were meetings. And I remember one of the early ones we had as a guest, Phil LaFollette. Phil LaFollette impressed me immediately when I met him because he recalled that his father had, and I think perhaps he too, had been a lecturer in Chautauqua at the hometown in Geneseo, Illinois. And I could see how he, as a politician, knew the importance of remembering names and places. But at this early, one of these early meetings, we had a discussion of civil rights and civil liberties. And in the middle of the discussion, Phil LaFollette said, the important thing is not the right to freedom of speech and press, religion. Important rights are the rights to education, to have a family, have a decent standard of living. And this was my really my first encounter with this kind of economic and social emphasis. And I have never forgot Phil LaFollette's contribution at that early meeting. There was not much social structure within the department, as I recall it, because by the nature of our living, of my living in the graduate group out at Adams Hall, I was able to have a very fine interreaction with other graduate students, some of which has continued to this day. For example, George Abernethy, who finished his doctorate in philosophy and for a long time has been at Davidson College in North Carolina. Adel Larson in agricultural economics in one of the Oklahoma institutions. Indeed, that old association at Richardson in Adams Hall was a very fine one. And we tended to eat at the same table, six at a table. And for 2 years, we carried on a word game. It was, I don't know, called pig or something of this sort, where the person who was at the head of the table began a word game that began with two letters, like HB, and then you would add letters on either side, and the one who ended the word was the pig. And if you, the one who had the most pigs or the one who had failed to continue the word the most times had to sit at the head of the table at the next meeting and start the game. And commonly at my table, as I remember, were Dick Cox, who was became a chemist, was a good chemist, and Frank Siniago, George Woolley, were among those that were frequently participating in this game situation. The food was just excellent at the Commons, and the living conditions were marvelous. At in the complex, there was a library, and you could go down and check out books, reading books, and there were reference books. At noon, the graduate students, we frequently played card games, including cribbage. It was a good interrelationship with scientists, too, and that was good, I think, in terms of broadening one's experience. Indeed, in these days, before a high proportion of students were married, this kind of activity was great from an intellectual point of view. The number of graduate students in political science was, of course, rather small. And as I look over the names on the graduation list, Lee Green, who was subsequently to become an important political scientist in Tennessee, I got to know very well, but more subsequently. John Lewis, the authority on Teutonic origins of constitutional government, and had the fortunate break of being able to work on an article with Charles Beard that was published in the Review, was one that I came to know very well. And Jasper Shannon, in my neighboring Nebraska, and I had frequent interchange of views subsequently. In 35 also was to graduate Hollis Barber, and you can see the natural confusion with a barber and a farber in the department at the same time. Hollis Barber, who has finished his teaching career at the University of Illinois Chicago Circle, was one of my good friends at the time, and he had had the advantage of having studied in Germany. The classrooms were rather small, but in most classes that which I participated, there were only 20 to 30 students. There was a political science room in the university library that had some special collections in it. The offices were rather small. I like the smallness of the department itself, because there was an opportunity to meet with the professors, but not very much as socially. Sharp had a sort of a militaristic approach, and I believe he had been an Army officer. Most of them seemed to be so involved in research as not to spend too much time with students. But I never felt that I had any difficulty with respect to this, but maybe this may have been because I really never had any serious problems that had to be worked out. The economics department had a very fine reputation at the time, and of course there was Elizabeth Brandeis in economics, who was an outstanding individual. With respect to a student life, I've already noted the unusual arrangements with respect to room and board and how they very much contributed to my life at the University of Wisconsin. I did go to athletic events on the campus, and I was especially interested in boxing, which was one of the top-rated sports at the time. I also attended football games, but after Northwestern University, Wisconsin was such a letdown that it was not nearly as exciting as the championship teams at Northwestern University had at the time. There were a number of cultural things in the Memorial Union, and I did attend some of the concerts there in the afternoon, partly because I felt that they were important to attend. We had a good social life, though, in the dorm situation, and we had some outside speakers. I remember once that E.A. Ross, the famous sociologist who had been fired at Stanford for his criticism of Leland Stanford, gave a lecture on sex, and in which he pointed out that I remember him saying, "Well, you're living, she's living, why in the hell aren't you living together?" Thus advocating early the boys and girls really getting together and living together without the with or without the benefit of marriage. I did read the Daily Cardinal regularly, and I did use the Student Health Service because I was usually had a nervous stomach, and I remember going down and I got some pills for that because I was hyper tense in those often in those days. The political and social climate at the university and in Madison was very good. On Sunday, I frequently attended the perhaps always attended the Congregational Church, where Reverend Swan gave these very fine lectures on social problems and political problems. I was very lucky because at Northwestern I had Ernest Fremont Tittle, the Methodist preacher, was similarly a preacher of the social gospel. And so between Tittle and Swan, I felt that my Sundays were far from being wasted at either institution. Glenn Frank was very important as a sort of a role model, and it was in those days where they were trying to start the Liberal Party, and I did attend that big mass meeting where they were talking about third parties. He had also been very important in terms of the Honors College and, what was it, the Michael John College, that, and there was still some discussion of that while I was there. But I never had any direct contact with Glenn Frank. The university library then was subject to this very unfortunate division between the historical library and the university library proper. And that was just absolutely absurd and, of course, ought not to have existed. But the library was excellent, particularly for its frontier materials. I was very much impressed with what the historical library had done in the collecting of newspapers, early newspapers, in the Middle West. I would say that the library was very excellent indeed, and I, as long as we had access to the shelves, there was no problem. With respect to women at the university, see, there was one woman that worked with Dr. Ogg, a graduate student, I think Mary Trackett, who was fairly aggressive. But otherwise, there were just no women around, and if you look over the list, you could see that there was no PhD production of women. I just don't think that the anything that there was no issue with respect to women because they just weren't there, and no one thought much about them, or for that matter, Jews or minority groups on the campus. I felt that the, in general though, that the campus was quite cosmopolitan, and I didn't feel that students from other than Wisconsin were badly treated. There are several additional matters on which I might comment that I haven't covered previously. For your records, you might note that in 1947, I was invited back as a lecturer in political science at the University of Wisconsin, that is during the summer. And I taught two classes. I had a big class in American government in Bascom Hall, and then I had a course in constitutional law. The constitutional law class contained, among others, Felix Nigro, who became a very famous political scientist, especially in the field of public administration and personnel. And I frequently see Felix, and our contact has been rather continuous and mutually advantageous. I shared an office at the time with Bill Stokes, who was very conservative, and we had interesting conversations frequently about politics. Although at that time I would have regarded myself also as a conservative. In addition, at noon, I ate with Bill Young and Leon Epstein, period. I also became acquainted with Henry Hart, period. Other staff members that subsequently I've come to know fairly well are James L. McCamey, Ralph Hewitt, and Clara Penniman. As you can see, my years at Wisconsin caused me to have a deep commitment to political science and to the improvement of government in a practical way. While I was at Wisconsin, I spent considerable time with the Legislative Reference Service observing the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the legislature in action. Later on, I was to become the director of the first director of the Legislative Research Council here in the state of South Dakota, and indeed was rather important in its initial establishment. I was also to become the director of the Office of Price Administration's Price Program in South Dakota, and part of this was because the appointing officials were impressed with my Wisconsin background. I also did consulting work for the Civil Service Commission, was a member of Truman's Regional Loyalty Board. Other carry-through in the practical side of government have resulted in my serving as 10 years as chairman of the City Planning Commission for the City of Vermilion, where many of the ideas of John Goss in the planning field became important. I also served for 3 years as the secretary of the Committee on Education, Cultural Affairs, and Information for the North Atlantic Assembly, and was instrumental in the establishment of a seminar in the College of Europe at Bruges in the for NATO public servants. More recently, since 1972, I worked with the Brookings Institution and now with Princeton University with Dick Nathan on the impact studies of various federal programs on state and local government, and I have served as the South Dakota representative. Thus, this year, I've just completed a 50-page report for Princeton University on the impact of the Reagan program on South Dakota and South Dakota state government, which is now available for distribution by Princeton University. Thus, what Wisconsin did for me was to provide the stimulus to become involved in my subject as it applied to the problems of the world, but particularly on the state and local level. One interesting carry through for this type of approach has occurred on my retirement. I was asked what sort of memorial that I might be interested in, and I suggested that a fund be established to provide for fight funds for internships and travel. As a result, a group of graduates from the University of South Dakota formed a committee, and to date, approximately $102,000 has been collected. The income from now is now used annually to provide funds to encourage students to participate as interns and to travel. The goal is to secure about $400,000 for this purpose. And indeed, in my teaching, I have tried to emphasize the importance of commitment and involvement. And as a consequence, perhaps, there has been a stream of very fine students come out of this institution in the field of political science and in the communicative arts. For example, Charles O. Jones, who has been editor of the American Political Science Review, and Sam Patterson, who will be the editor of the American Political Science Review shortly, were graduates of the University of South Dakota, and I was able to send them to the University of Wisconsin, where they received fellowships, and both secured their PhDs from Wisconsin. We have had a number of other students subsequently go to Wisconsin, including Phil O'Dean, who is a vice president of Coopers and Libran. Among the other distinguished graduates from the department here have been Tom Brokaw, the NBC anchorman, and Pat O'Brien, CBS, Ken Bodie of NBC, and Al Newhart, the editor of USA Today. There have been a number of other political scientists who have graduated here as well. This then concludes the interview with William O. Farber of Vermilion, South Dakota. Except for a short comment that is on the other side of this belt. Free to either call me or write me, and I will provide additional information. It's been a pleasure to participate in the project. The short comment that I want to add is with respect to the requirements for the degree in the field of language. At the time, the two foreign languages were required, and I took French and German. I'd had 2 years of French at Northwestern, and I came armed with a letter from the chairman of the French department at the university, at Northwestern University, saying that I was competent. But the chairman at Wisconsin said, well, if you're competent, take this and read it and translate it. This I attempted to do, and I think more out of pride than any deficiency on my part. He said, well, you better do a little more work and then we'll test you again. And in the subsequent test, I had no difficulty. But German was an entirely different matter. And I had had no German, so I took a course with a lady and in the evening and worked very hard on it. But German is very difficult to acquire quickly. And the only thing that I could do in order to pass that test was to read a biography in German of Stresemann, and for which there was an English translation, and practically memorize the book, which I did. Even so, since it's not difficult to cross up a person in an examination, I had to make certain that when we had this, when the test was given, and it was done orally, that I got in the right line, as they said, since there were two examining props, one tough and one easy. And those that knew the German, they would be willing to switch so that they get in the tough line, and those that didn't know, they could get in the easy line, which I did. It was rough, but I did pass the German. One other requirement was a course in statistics. And thus, this fortunately was with Sam Stauffer, who became the distinguished professor in quantitative methods at Harvard University and wrote on very frequently on subjects connected with the military. But I took the course, a regular course, in this given by the sociology department with undergraduates, and that was enough to qualify me for the statistical requirement for the degree in political science. I'm afraid that in the previous presentation, I have not adequately noted the debt that I felt that I owed to Frederick Austin Ogg. His reputation in political science was so overwhelming that he was able to help considerably in the placement of the graduates. Thus, when the spring of 1935 came around and I was looking for a job, and jobs were still scarce as they had been since my getting a BA degree in 32 at Northwestern, I remember going in his office, and he said, well, he'd had a couple of notices. One was from the University of South Dakota, where the president was a political scientist, Herman James, distinguished political science in Latin American matters, and whose father had been president of Northwestern and the University of Illinois. And he himself had been dean at Nebraska and chairman of the political science department at the University of Texas. At any rate, James had contacted Ogg about the possibility of someone teaching at the University of South Dakota. The other vacancy that was reported was the University of Alabama. And I remember Professor Ogg saying, Farber, these are tough times. You haven't much to choose from. South Dakota and Alabama. But he said, I think South Dakota is better than Alabama, as indeed I think it was too in 1935. So I went down and was interviewed by President James at the old Morrison Hotel in Chicago and got the job. Hollis Barber, who was getting his degree at the same time, took the Alabama job. But it was Ogg that did it, and no one else, that helped us get those positions. And Ogg's concern for his students and help us in this kind of thing was, of course, extremely important. Subsequently, as I attended the meetings of the American Political Science Association, I saw Ogg at work and how methodical he was, how accurate he was, how fair he was. He was an old, he was a gentleman of the old school, and one could not but admire him and hope in some way to emulate him. Frankly, I never felt that the University of Wisconsin honored him sufficiently, and I felt that he did not feel sufficiently recognized either as he grew older, and I've been surprised that he did not leave more of a financial legacy to the University of Wisconsin, considering the way that he was wrapped up with the institution. He was such a hard worker, and I remember he told me that he had a treaty. I don't know if that was quite his term, but anyway, it seemed to amount to that, at least an agreement with his wife, that he would work 4 days a week, and Sunday was hers. And sometimes he'd be going to a concert on Sunday. It was her day, and she just told him what he had to do. And so he was rigidly regarded this sort of a truce, and she could dictate what did occur on the on the seventh day. But as I've stated, he was a real gentleman, and he was a symbol of stability and excellence, and as such meant a great deal to the graduate students of the time. One final note. In the fall of 1934, I attended in Chicago a meeting of the American Political Science Association. At that meeting, there was all kinds of discussion as to what would be the fate of the New Deal legislation in the Supreme Court. And E.S. Corwin, a distinguished Princeton University professor, predicted that the Supreme Court would bend with the times. And he had written his book, The Twilight of the Supreme Court, on the subject. And most of the political science in attendance at this meeting, this particular panel, agreed with the Corwin point of view. But toward the end, a man in the corner stood up, and it was John R. Commons. And he said, anyone who has studied the political sciences institution knows that the trend has gone too far, and that the legislation would be declared unconstitutional. And subsequently, of course, we got the AAA and NRA cases. Then I was very much impressed with the institutional economics of John R. Commons, and this set me to reading such books as The Legal Foundations of Capitalism. Indeed, it was this kind of social ferment that was going on at the time, coupled with the activism of the Wisconsin professors, that has served as a sort of a model for me all during the time that I have served as a political scientist here at the University of South Dakota. That's all on the tape.